With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This week on Leninist Out Loud, I'm going to meet a man who studied economics, worked in the city, but now sets puzzles for a living. In respect of which, warm greetings to Tim, who sends me my favourite puzzle for some time. What do you get if you cross a joke with a rhetorical question? It's Saturday the 23rd of May, 2015. I'm N. Quentin Wolfe, and this is Leninist Out Loud.
Hey baby, let me take you down to a place of strange sights and sounds you ain't never seen the like before. Just a stone's throw from your front door. Hey baby, sniff out me, see the piece of the air, land in the sea, some creep, some saw down the road, jam brand store.
My heart aches for some far off place.
Well, hello, listener. We're going to start with a puzzle. We are 14 floors up, looking out over London. With me is Tom Williams. He's the director of A Door in a Wall. Let's start by trying to guess where we are. I'm going to hand you over to Tom, and he's going to describe what we can see out of the window. Where are we?
So, we're looking north. We're somewhere on the east side of town. We can see the Olympic Park from where we are. All around us is a landmark development of the 1950s. Over to our west, we've got the towers of the City of London, and we can see all the new development around Stratford as well. To our east, another landmark, the Balfron Tower.
From which we have broadcast in the past. For this interview, I got off at All Saints on the DLR and progressed past the Crisp Street Ideas Door, which means we are
in Crisp Street Market.
In Crisp Street Market. We've got a bird's eye view.
We do. We're up on in Fitzgerald House, casting our bird's eye view over Crisp Street and the surrounding area.
Now, I've been for this show to some salubrious establishments, and this ain't one of them. It looks to me like a council flat, but in a pretty poor state of repair. What are we doing here?
This is one of the locations that we're using for our latest mystery adventure, which is taking place around this area all this month. We've been working with the housing association, Poplar Harker, who very kindly set us up with a few interesting locations in and around their sphere of influence here in Poplar.
Have I just offended the housing association in question?
Possibly, but they deliberately gave us a bit of a fixer-upper.
This is one that has clearly been well lived in, let's put it that way. And what is the reason for using a location such as this?
Well, the area is very much a subject of invitation. It's not an area that that I knew particularly well before I came here. But the guys at Poplar Harker are always keen to publicise the area, to get new people to come here and show off the things that are here. And, you know, we've been delighted with what we've been able to do. So they've given us access to all these fantastic locations. And it's been a real pleasure coming to an area of East London that that I don't know much about, and showing it to other people that don't know much about it.
That spirit of not knowing too much pervades my interviewing approach today. You've been highly recommended, I should say. A Door in the Wall has been commended by one of the Londonist writers, Beth Parnell Hopkinson, who put me onto you. And she said, yeah, these guys are doing great stuff and you need to talk to them. What have you been doing that's impressed us?
Well, thank you for the kind words. It's always hard to explain what we do. It's always a mishmash of murder mystery, of treasure hunts, of adventure, but always keeping that in the real world. We always use real London locations to show people either places they do know in a new way, or introduce them to places that they don't know so well. We write murder mystery stories normally, or other kinds of stories, and then we find locations, interesting places to take people around certain areas, which we then populate with clues, with actors, with secrets, and people follow these clues around, find these actors, uncover these secrets, and try and piece together the bizarre twists and turns of our plots. So there's a bit of competition in there, but largely it's a fun adventure for people to take part in of an evening or a weekend afternoon. So we've just come into the offices of Older and Older, which is our venue for the life and death of Paul Moraine. We've done a lot of set design work on this. We're very pleased with it. It's a 1950s styled solicitor's office. We've got Festival of Britain posters on the walls. We've got wood panelling. We've got metal filing cabinets, low desks, and Danish style seating all around. This is sort of the main space that the players come into and what they experience when they arrive in our game in around Crisp Street. Yeah, we really wanted to sort of set the scene a little bit, draw on that 50s heritage, and sort of provide an interesting place for people to explore and poke around. We don't mind people sort of rifling through the cabinets and the books that we've got piled everywhere here for people to do. In fact, there's a whole challenge based around rifling through some of the cabinets, which is good fun. And again, the sort of meeting actors here. We have an actor that sort of inhabits this space and some of the other spaces that we've decked out. We've got everything from a secretive military basement, meditation room, and a banker boardroom that people enter at various times and explore and interact with characters in those spaces. So obviously we have a variety of interactions in this game, but we've got a whole host of things we've done in the past as well. We've had backstreet surgeries where you're rooting around inside bodies. We've had mini golfers who take it far, far too seriously. Fortune tellers, scout masters, rickshaw drivers. These are all sorts of the kind of characters that we force people to interact with and have adventures alongside.
Sounds like a lot of fun. There's clearly a taste and appetite for this sort of thing. One thinks of one or two of the other big companies doing variations on a similar kind of idea, surprises and secrets and so forth. I want to ask you about the practicalities of doing that, because when one thinks of what's been going on in the last couple of years, they have been beset by problems of various sorts. It's interesting to know how you go about doing this. But on one hand, it sounds a little bit like the sort of thing that I quite enjoyed doing as a kid, setting up for games and stuff like this. Is this an extended childhood going on here?
I think it is and it isn't, in that it taps into a sense of play and a sense of adventure and role-playing especially. But I also think it's a little more sophisticated than that. We always try and pitch what we're doing as a game rather than theatre. And, you know, gaming is something that everybody does these days. And it's a difficult game. We're not in the business of making sort of things you can sort of solve in 5 minutes. The stories we write and the mysteries we try and pursue are designed to be complex and intricate, and so there should be a real satisfaction when people get it right, when they crack that code, when they decipher that puzzle and make that deduction. That's important to us, that it is complex and it is pitched at an adult level.
So it's an intellectual challenge as well. Is this a prizes for everyone type setup though, or are there winners and losers? Is there one person who figures it out and then the game's over, or how does it work?
Everybody has a go. Everybody writes down what they find, and then somebody will have done the best job at that, and they win a prize. The prizes are often fairly nominal token things. You know, we spend our budget on the experiences that everyone gets to enjoy. It's about that satisfaction of, yes, we cracked it. Yes, we did the best. And we got something to take home and put on our mantelpiece to show that we did that. There's an element of competition, and some people get really into that. But primarily, it's about the journey that people go on.
What about your journey? The first thing that I have on an instinctual level here, and this might be highly subjective, is I can only imagine there must be times when you have been given a new place, such as the one we're in now, and you're able to just absorb it What's your journey as you, for example, arrive at a new location, a new place that you've been lent?
Well, I think it's about looking at things with a set of fresh eyes, and I'm not going to sort of pretend that I've somehow got sort of magic eyes that I can see things that other people can't. But
you know, we only booked you because of your magic eyes.
I think they do a test. The way we go about sort of our location scouting, once we've got a main venue source, that's always usually the hardest challenge in what we do. Sourcing main venue, and then we look for interesting places around that venue. Typically for a game, we might look for sort of maybe 20 other locations to use. And it's key to have variety. The idea being that you'll send people down a street and they won't know exactly what they're looking for. The next clue, the next part of the adventure could sort of be behind any, you know, as our name suggests, door in a wall. You're looking for things you can make a puzzle out of, you know, pieces of sort of lettering or numbers or patterns, or just something distinctive, something you walk down the street and go, that's unusual, I wonder why that's there. But conversely, you can also use things that are very, very conventional and sort of subvert them in some way.
But this sounds like the same set of instincts that drive a lot of people who are interested in secret London, and people who have become tour guides as well, and they pick up on these little unusual things and they can't rest until they know the story behind that and what it means and how it adds into the whole. I wonder, is there a concrete example that you could give us maybe from a previous escapade?
Certainly. Yeah, so there's actually something we're doing in this game we're doing at the moment that has worked really well for us. Again, just something seen by chance, a piece of art, a sculpture, in a small park near here, and just the way it was aligned, it used glass so that you could stand on one side of it and see through and see things through the other side, and that just enables you to construct a really nice sort of perspective puzzle by getting people to stand in a certain place and see something through something else, which would highlight an object that they then had to go and find as their next location. It's not particularly complicated. It doesn't really require doing anything too intrusive, but that use of something that was there all along and getting people something, again, it could be something that people walk past every single day and they wouldn't have thought of what it could mean or what it might lead them on to.
Oh, that's interesting. That actually answers a question that was bubbling up that I hadn't quite fully formulated. But you know those films from the 60s where there's some sort of a race or a chase going on, and to confound those behind them, the people up ahead turn the direction arrows at the side of the road round to point in the other direction. It occurs to me that one of the cornerstones of the British character is a determination to slightly tinker at the edges of somebody else's grand plan. And I could well imagine if you've got clues scattered all around an area, people will take great delight in adjusting them for their merriment.
Well, yeah, I won't pretend it never happens, but thankfully it is quite rare.
But all the same, it's a lot of different moving parts that you seem to be talking about, and it must be easy for the general public to get involved, even by accident, and throw things completely off kilter, even without your knowing it.
Oh, of course, it's a liability you accept, but over the years we've got better and better at knowing what's likely to go wrong and what isn't. Obviously, when you do everything you can to make sure that things won't go missing, i.e., you know, either you secure things or you have things in places where you've got the proper permissions to put them, so that they're not going to go anywhere, and you've got people keeping an eye on them. And we also have a crew in the field at all times, just looping, circulating, making sure that everything we have out there is doing what it's supposed to do and is in the right place and gets set up properly and taken down properly. You can never completely eliminate that risk. It's an element of just having to accept that if you're going to have your clues out there in the real world. But it's a risk we take.
How many of these have you done?
I was just counting through them the other day because I had to stop and think about it. Of these sorts of public events, I think this is our 10th, the one we're doing at the moment. And then we've done other sort of private things as well in between those. So, yeah, and we've gradually sort of been iterating and building out what we do so that we learn things from every event. We always try and do a few new things, try and push it in some different directions, and obviously change the locations we use. So gradually we get better and better at what we do, hopefully.
I know you said you were avoiding theatre, which that's an interesting choice to make, really. It seems like that's one of the big decisions you've got to make, isn't it? Maybe we could talk more about that. Are there fashions in this kind of thing? Do you find yourself looking maybe at competition or maybe at just what's going on generally in town or in cities, plural? Are there fashions that you've got to keep one step ahead of? How does that stuff work?
There might be. If there are, I don't think we pay much attention to them.
Now, does that mean you're not going out and sampling the puzzle craft of other organisations?
Well, we certainly do. We certainly do. But we're trying to, I guess, in those instances, we're more interested in what people are doing on a sort of micro level, i.e. sort of individual puzzles and things. And you're always interested in seeing the moving parts of other people's machinery. But in terms of the sort of theming and the bigger picture, I think we very much like to go in our own direction, and we rely on the sort of feedback of our audience. We're very rigorous about collecting feedback about what people like, what people don't like, and we're always trying to improve what we do. But again, it's from a very sort of iterative place, sort of starting with what we have and seeing, well, how can we make it better, or how can we try to put a new spin on it? That's not really in an essence to ever try and capture a trend, or not consciously anyway.
How deeply involved do you get with an area? Are you just passing through?
To an extent, we are always just passing through, because we're always... we never root ourselves in one place. You know, we're doing our event around here in Poplar temporarily, and you know, we hope to look to do another event in the autumn, and that'll be somewhere completely different. So I can't pretend that we're hugely deeply rooted. But I think our events recognise that yes, everyone is just passing through, and how do you create a really memorable, powerful experience for people, so that even if they are just passing through, they remember it. And if they remember it, they're more likely to come back. Certainly what we're trying to do here in Poplar is sort of give people a fun adventure in a place they might not know so well, and show them what it has to offer. And we look to do that in all the areas that we use. And some of them are more well-known than others. Our last event was all around London Bridge. And, you know, when you're running past Tower Bridge and stuff like that, that's very familiar territory for a lot of people. But even so, again, you can have fun with those sorts of things, again, in looking at them in a new way, even if you've seen them before.
I think I need a more concrete example. Maybe we could use that previous game. But I think I need to understand in a little bit more detail how this works.
So, structurally, people turn up. They are introduced to the little world we've created. They're always sort of fairly sort of silly, outlandish stories. Murder mysteries are our stock in trade. They're a nice format that everyone's kind of familiar with. You've got to squeeze these things into an evening. So
something very weirdly comforting about murder, isn't it? what is that? Why do we consume so much murder as comforting entertainment?
I think it's just, it creates such a great setup for a story. The whodunit is just sort of endlessly fascinating, and murder just by its very nature gives you a sort of a victim who can't talk. And this inherent sense of mystery of, like, you know, if only we could have seen through their eyes, we'd know what had happened. But we don't. We have to sort of build it up from everything else that we know around it. And murder mystery is so helpful just because it gives you this natural framework to kind of slot a story into. You don't have to get over a hurdle of trying to explain too much about what's going on, because as soon as you tell people, this person's died, here are some suspects, find out who done it, people instantly know what kind of world they're in, what kind of territory they're exploring.
And there's a finite endpoint as well, having cracked this particular question clearly. Okay, so you've gathered together, here's the premise.
Yes.
What's next?
What's next is 2 hours of, or there or thereabouts, depending on the event, of running around finding clues. We normally sort of set up clues in sort of short trails of sort of 3 or 4 locations, and maybe there'll be sort of 6 or so of those little trails. And so people are exploring. They're kind of on their own agenda, so they choose where they go. We sort of say, here are all your options. You've got 2 hours. Explore as many of them as you can.
You presumably give them an idea of which direction to go in or something.
Absolutely. Right. We give them some leads to start. So we say, these are the start of these trails. You can go and follow them in any order, find as many clues as you can, meet as many characters as you can, which they'll encounter along the way. And the more they find, the more pieces of the story they get. And obviously the more pieces of story they get, the better their conclusion at the end is going to be. After that period, they will come back to the where they started out, furiously scribble down their answers, and we collect them in and see who's done the best job of that.
I'm trying to work out what the contents of your head, how you see yourself as well, maybe, as somebody entertaining others, or is there a sort of a brain in a jar here enjoying its own imagination?
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. and UnitedHealthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Or are you quite enjoying toying with people, or, you know, what's the process?
I think there's a little bit of both those things. There is an inevitable entertainment value in sort of being that puppet master and pulling the strings and knowing what's going on behind the scenes. I think it's fun being on both sides of the screen, but the premise for us is creating something that is fun and exciting for the people doing it. It's got to be, otherwise they don't come back. Creating something that's unexpected, so you kind of get the pleasure of setting things up, which then people run into as they explore. And that's very satisfying, knowing that people are suddenly stumbling into this world you've created and enjoying the surprises and the action that you've set up.
Well, yeah, because I can see from the way you're talking about it that you are getting something more. You're not a clinical entrepreneur who's spotted a niche here. Clearly, there's entrepreneurialism going on, but there's also obviously a satisfaction on your part in something to do with this. What about on the flip side, though? What are the things that are the real flies in the ointment for you?
Well, we've already touched on one of them in the sort of the risks of not knowing how sort of vulnerable your clues are out there in the real world. But as I say, we got better and better at that. Logistically, it's really complicated. I mean, again, we've got better and better at it. We've got a lot of processes and things that we do now that help us keep everything safe and robust and sensible. And we know it's going to work. But yeah, there's a lot of moving parts for these things. There's a lot of different, you've got to have a story that holds together. You've got to have all the clues kind of conveying that story and working together and making sense so that when somebody does it, they can actually solve the mystery and that all works. You've got to have a lot of different people, cast, crew, everyone's got to be at certain places at certain times. I mean, that's the same as theatre, but you're kind of, it's writ large almost, because you're not just doing it in a theatre, you're doing it over, you know, streets all around one area.
And on that point, with different attendees each time you run the event, presumably that must introduce an element of variation. They've got crowd A on the Monday night, containing, let's say, an unusually introverted bunch who handle things in one way. Crowd B on the Tuesday is much more out there and they process things in an entirely different way. What's the elasticity of the experience? How much can you kind of stay in control, and how much is it shaped by the people who turn up?
Naturally, you know, we're meeting our audience halfway. It is an interactive experience. It's designed as a game, and games are interactive, and you want to give people agency and have them decide what they want to do. Obviously, we sort of create the framework that people move in, and you know, people can go different ways with it, but ultimately they're still trying to follow the same paths and come to the same conclusions. One thing that does give us a great deal of elasticity is the actor interactions that we use, and when players interact with characters, that's largely improvised. It's not scripted, so that players who are really up for it and want to role play and want to get involved, the actors can really dial it up and get them involved and pick on people and make it more spontaneous. If people are more reserved, they're a bit shy, they're not so into that, which not everyone is, that's fine. They, again, they can go through the interaction, hit the key points, do some entertaining bits that are just largely self-propelled and send the team on their way, and those people can have the experience that they want to have as well. But it's always surprising how into it people do get. I'm always kind of impressed. I always think, oh, well, you know, we've got to cater for people who maybe aren't into that so much. But by and large, people really do want to get involved. It's really encouraging, actually, when once you give people a platform or sort of open a door for them or present them with a character who they kind of get the gist of, people are very willing to step into that space and become part of it themselves.
Tell me about the first time you did something like this. I don't know if you would have been doing it professionally at that point or not.
Well, A Door in the Wall grew out of something we just did for friends, really, initially. And the first few things we'd done along these lines really kind of reflected that. It was just a load of friends trying to do something, finishing a lot of sentences that began, wouldn't it be cool if? And it was huge, it was sprawling. I think we sort of had clues up around seven areas of London. It was all over central London. I mean, in a way, it was much bigger than what we're doing at the moment. It was sort of lasted all day on a Saturday, and we had all kinds of things set up, and half of them broke, and nobody got round even like half all of the locations, and so nobody had even close to the right answer for the stories and things. But ultimately, people still had a great time. I thought, well, you know, that was a laugh. I mean, it was a load of work, but it was a laugh. Let's do it again. We did a few more along those lines. Again, just iterating, getting the format better and better every single time. And sort of, you know, by the time we'd done sort of four or five of them, it had really kind of snowballed beyond, let's do something for friends, and then it was friends of friends and friends of 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 friends. And I thought, well, you know, we've got to charge a bit more money to cover the costs and get a bit more serious with it. And, you know, people are coming and they expect something good. So let's make it good and do it properly.
Well, it sounds like there's a watershed moment in there then somewhere where there must have been a point when you've for the first time said, OK, we need to charge some money for this. How did that moment go?
Well, that was even that first event that I've described. We asked people for just a little bit of money. I think it was like £5 or something each, just to sort of cover the costs. I mean, we weren't paying anybody to be in it. I was just literally to cover the costs of, like, I don't know, printing stuff out and buying some props and stuff like that.
So you never had the awkward moment of having to say to your chums, you know, cough up now. It was free last time, but no more for you.
Well, it's been a ratchet. Sort of gradually, we kept doing that. We wanted to do more. We got more ambitious. So we kept on bumping up that contribution from people. By the time of our event, Shakes on a Plane, which in many ways was a kind of a real landmark event for us.
It makes me extremely nervous from the title.
It's very literal. It was a murder mystery story about a sheikh who died on a plane.
Okay, I'm relieved immediately. I'm really not sure where that was going. Let's turn our gaze outwards. We're going to take a word from our sponsor, audible.co.uk. You can get a free book from Audible. All you need to do is go to audible.co.uk/Londonist and click through and claim your freebies. If you're not yet trying Audible, then a free 30-day trial will cost you nothing. We'll get you your free book. It'll keep us on the air. What's not to like?
Londonist Out Loud is available free as a stream at Londonist.com or a weekly download via iTunes. Hit us up on Facebook at Londonist Out Loud, tweet at Londonist Sound, and check out images of our guests via the Londonist Out Loud stream on Instagram.
You're listening to Londonist Out Loud. I'm in Quentin Wolfe. With me, Tom Williams, who is the director of A Door in a Wall, which is, as you'll have gathered by now, a mysteries project. Is that a fair description?
Sort of. We're a lot of things. I like to think of us as games makers. We make games, we make adventures. They happen to be mysteries as well, so that's not a totally inaccurate.
Oh, it's too restrictive. Okay.
Yeah.
We're looking down on, as we mentioned before, Crisp Street Market. You mentioned that this area experienced quite a lot of investment and development in the 50s. You can certainly see swathes of distinct architecture as you look out here. Maisonettes over the rows of shops just there. As you go further back, I'm guessing they might be more sort of 60s or 70s construction, that sort of period. Some of the much taller blocks, I guess they'd be about 10 stories a piece. Construction carries on around us, and there's some exciting tower blocks in brown and bright orange and gold over there behind the church. Isn't that interesting how the church kind of vanishes essentially in front of those? As somebody who's been working in this area for a little while now on the latest experience, what can you tell us that you've learnt about this area?
Well, we tried really hard to introduce a lot of local history, of local knowledge into the game that we're doing, along with the sort of more fanciful, sillier elements that we always kind of cover everything in. But the really interesting things about this area, I think, sort of stem from, as you mentioned, it's history in the 50s. Poplar was the site of the architecture exhibition of the Festival of Britain in 1951. Obviously, most of it in London anyway sort of happened down on the South Bank, but in the East End here, they showcased the architecture. And that was largely, obviously, 1951. A lot of the East End was rubble, and they were trying to build homes of the future. This was really where they wanted to showcase what architecture could be for the rest of the 20th century. And so a lot of the buildings that we're looking at the moment down around Crisp Street Market, it's a fantastic clock tower in the market, which also sort of stems from that development. And
does it really? It doesn't look old enough, does it?
Obviously it was designed to be forward-looking of its time, so I guess you probably would look at it and think it was built later, but certainly these buildings all on the north side, and the clock tower, and several of the other buildings around here on the Lansbury estate, named for George Lansbury, popular MP, local hero in many regards, and father of Angela Lansbury, to tie it back to mysteries. But 1951, yeah, huge year for here. A lot of the buildings are listed. And it was very exciting. It was a very optimistic time. People were looking to kind of move on and try and imagine a better place to live, a better way to live. And it's kind of surprising that not that many people know about it. It probably wasn't the most successful bit of the Festival of Britain. Not that many people actually came and saw it. And critically, it wasn't that well received either. I think a lot of these sort of contemporary architects at the time were sort of looked down on it and thought it was kind of what they were trying to do was a bit old-fashioned, even when they brought it out. They were trying to be sort of very modernist, but maybe the modernism had already peaked. I don't know, I'm not an architecture critic myself, but regurgitating what I've read about it. But I thought that sense of optimism and the sort of desire to do things in a better way was something we wanted to incorporate into our story, which sort of very much features a central character who tries and doesn't always succeed, but always tries to make the world a better place.
It suddenly occurred to me, I was thinking what an enormous jump it is to get from the 2 and 3 story terraces that we're seeing below us to the brutalist towers in the space of a decade. That's a big leap in terms of ideology as much as anything else. But it occurred to me that I don't know what we're standing in. I was paying very little attention as we rushed in through the front door. What kind of tower block are we on the 14th floor of?
Well, it's Fitzgerald House. It's about 20 stories tall. It's grey. It's concretey, but it holds together all right. And the rooms inside here are well proportioned, which is something more than can be said for a lot of new build flats. So it's got that as an edge, even if from the outside it does look a bit grey, a bit concretey, and not what many people would imagine as being an exciting home of the future.
Well, let's pass through. I never waste an opportunity to get a bird's eye view of town. We're going to go through to the other side of the building now into a sitting room with the stuff that I can't possibly discuss for reasons of confidentiality. Which direction are we looking in now?
So we are looking east towards the Balfron Tower, out also towards bits of the new residential developments just on the north edge of the Isle of Dogs. We can see the Thames from here. Again, looking east, we see the cable car. And again, lots of building work, lots of cranes.
This is starting to look a lot like Coruscant.
It is. Towers going up everywhere, but it's just a reflection of London's popularity, and I think in the Londonist mantra, build more houses. Good to see them going up.
Do you get the impression then? Because one of the things you notice when there's big towers like that starting to loom up, your eye begins to be attracted by the shakier or more dilapidated looking buildings around them, and you start to get an idea that they might be the next ones to be replaced. What's your sense of the area here at the foot of this tower and the Crisp Street Market? Do you think this is in it for the long haul, or do you think developers will be moving in here before long?
There's already a lot of development going on around here, but Poplar Harker, the the Housing Association, you know, work really closely with them. They have their own a lot of the land around here. They have their objectives to provide sustainable, affordable housing. I know they've got big plans for what they're doing around the market. There's going to be some more regeneration work around there. It's a constant process of change. There are things that are going to be here for ages. There's a lot of the buildings are listed for architectural importance. They'll certainly stay. But yeah, some of the buildings probably do need replacing. I'd like to think that the process of regeneration is one of keeping the best of what you've got and building on it, making better things for the future.
Well, we've got to come to a close, but I think we can't come to an end without a puzzle or two, a fact or two about the local area. I think I've got a puzzle for you.
Yeah.
I think. We'll see how you get on with it. Shame myself completely. But what can we say about Poplar? Let's have some nuggets.
Well, in addition to all the Lansbury things, there's a few other things I can tell you about Poplar. Obviously, the Balfron Tower is a huge local landmark. And indeed, the architect himself, Erno Goldfinger, used to reside on the top floor there and threw many a party for the great and the good to show them what he was up to. I can also tell you that there's not one, but two pie and mash shops in the immediate vicinity of where we are. I've sampled both of them.
And the best one is
I'll let you decide for yourself. But if you are in there, do get your pie and mash with liquor, parsley gravy. It's very, very important to have the triumvirate of pie, mash and liquor. I will also give a shout on a continued food theme. I will also give a shout out to the Bite food market they have here last Friday of every month. It's very good. There's lots of very exciting traders out here in East India Square. So yeah, do pop down and grab a bite to eat if you're local.
Okay, here we go. I'm going to see if I can out-puzzle you.
Okay, go ahead.
Crisp Street Market.
Yeah.
Is the first what?
Oh, it's the first pedestrianised market in Europe, I believe.
Damn, you're good. I certainly in the UK, I don't know about Europe, but I think you win that one hands down. There's a lovely piece of information that does seem to be a well-kept secret. You can get a fantastic cup of coffee in the Ideas store here on Crisp Street for 40p.
It's a bargain.
Yeah, I mean, it really is. So anyway, I'll be living in the Ideas store from now on. Can we have details of how people can come and be puzzled by you? That sounds like a personal judgment, doesn't it? I don't mean it like that. So that you, listener, can come and enjoy the fruits of Tom's labours.
Fruits of my labours. Poplar is, of course, a set for Call the Midwife as well. So it's a labours gag there somewhere. Yeah, please do come on to adoringawall.com. There are a very few tickets left for this current event. Probably literally about sort of 50 spaces left over the few dates we have remaining. So that runs until 31st of May. And
What does it cost?
So it costs £30 a person, or £17.50 if you're local. I.e., like you live in the immediate vicinity of the area, you've probably already...
Like I will do next to the coffee machine at the Ideas.
Yeah. Otherwise, we will look to have another public event later in the year. If you get on our mailing list, be the first person to know about that. And you can always find us on Facebook, on Twitter as well, just at A Door in a Wall.
Well, Tom Williams, thanks very much.
Yeah, thank you. It's been fun. My heart aches for some
far off. And that's all for this week. My thanks for this week to Tom Williams. Thanks too to Mark Barr and Bernie Barclay. Theme and incidental music was by Songs from the Howling Sea. I'm Ian Quentin Wolfe.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.